All right, he said finally, turning back to Maxwell. Until we hear something more from Barristia, we have to assume the Carisians truly have taken Chesterton and are advancing on Mayhem and probably Greentown. I'm inclined to think the column attack on Charlesville's a diversion. If I were the heretics, I wouldn't waste effort on the place. I'd want the Mayhem locks and the line of the mountain cross to Greentown a lot worse than a mostly destroyed town in the fork of two rivers I wasn't planning on using anyway. He shook his head. No. Mayhem would give me the best supply line for an advance on Allenton, and as soon as I had Brakeston and Greentown, I could pacify everything between there and the mountains with secondary forces. Considering the opposition, I could even do it with militiamen without rifles. Maxwell nodded, and Worsham continued. Send a dispatch to Bishop Quentin. Tell him he's to deploy his cavalry to most effectively protect the faithful in Midhold, coordinating with the faithful's forces in the field to the best of its ability, while maintaining a sufficient screen between Allenton and Greentown to locate, identify, and harry any advance in his direction. Yes, my lord. Maxwell's tone indicated that he understood why the mealy-mouthed, arse-covering first half of Bishop Quentin's orders was necessary, and that the second half was the critical one. After you do that, instruct Bishop Gothic, Bishop Adulfo, and Bishop Harris to prepare their divisions for movement. I want them fully supplied with food, ammunition, winter clothing, and artillery support. Find the wagons and dragons wherever you have to, and make their rifle regiments up to full strength, even if that means drafting men from other divisions. If anyone complains, tell them they can discuss it with me personally. Bishop Gothic will be the officer in command. Tell him to plan on moving to Allenton on very short notice, and that he'll assume command of all of our forces in Midhold from Bishop Quentin, if it proves necessary to send him there. And after you've done all that, I want a hard look at any additional cavalry we can squeeze out to send with him. Horsemen aren't going to do us any good in the gap, and if the heretics truly are pushing into Midhold, we need as much mobility as possible to deal with them. Yes, my lord. And while the colonel's doing that, Gordon, Worsham continued, turning to Lieutenant Feinstein with a wintry smile, I want you to request Bishop Ernest to join me here at his earliest convenience. Please inform him that it's very important I have the latest available information on possible additional heretic troop landings. If they really have moved significant forces into Midhold, they have to have come from somewhere, and we need to know where and in what sort of strength as quickly as we can. Walkyr Tyrnir felt an uncomfortable itch between his shoulder blades. There was no reason for it that he could see, and he told himself it was simply nerves. He'd united his regiment with Brinton Palmares as planned last night, and, as the senior colonel, taken command of the combined force. No regiment was ever fully up to strength, but he still had over 600 troopers moving down the farm track towards Mayhem, which was certainly a sufficiently powerful striking force to look after itself, and if he could get them across the Mayhem ferry to reinforce Tolivir. Of course, that assumed Tolivir was still in possession of Mayhem, but he'd become cautiously more optimistic about that as the 16th and the 53rd trotted steadily south without encountering any refugees from the town. He wouldn't have cared to try swimming the mountain cross himself, but there were enough boats in the town that someone should have gotten across before any heretic raiders could seize the place. By his calculations, they were within 3 or 4 miles of the river by now, though, raiding across the desolate, largely abandoned fields, and they'd met absolutely no one. At least the weather was clear and dry. Tyrnir was from the Duchy of Malansath, near the coast of the Gulf of Dolar, and September nights this far north were overly chilly for his taste. There had been frost this morning, and it had taken him the better part of an hour to get the blood circulating properly. Still, it had warmed up nicely since. The sky was clear, with only a handful of puffy white clouds, the sun was bright, and the breeze out of the north was merely brisk, without the bite it had carried right after dawn. It had turned into a pleasant day for a ride, in fact, and at this rate they'd reach the river in... His thoughts paused as a horseman came cantering toward the 16th Standard. He recognized one of his scouts, and those itching shoulders of his tightened as he observed the trooper's rapid pace. He threw up his hand, and his bugler sounded the halt as he drew rein. "Well, Sergeant?" he said as the scout reached him.
"Begging your pardon, sir, but there's what does look to be heretic regulars, Carisians at that, up ahead."
"There are." The non-com nodded, and a hollow sensation in the vicinity of his stomach joined the tension in Tiernier's shoulders.
"Yes, sir. Hard to mistake those uniforms."
"How many?"
"Don't have a hard count, sir, but I don't see how it could be more than a couple of hundred."
"You're confident of that?" Tiernier asked, deliberately keeping his tone calm, refusing to pressure the sergeant, even if it did sound suspiciously short of the 40 or 50,000 he'd been warned to expect.
"Like I say, we couldn't get a hard count, but it can't be much more than that, sir. I think they spotted our patrol, because they were just forming up on a little hill off in the fields to one side of the road when we saw them. Don't think they wanted to play catch-as-catch-can with cavalry in the open, and I can't say as I blame them, given how flat and open it is between here and the river. I circled round the far side of the hill myself, though, just to make sure they weren't hiding something nasty on t'other side of it. But it's not that much of a hill, when all's said. Barely big enough for the lot of them, and nothing behind it except more weeds and empty pastures."
"No guns?"
"None I could see, sir. Might be they've got a few of those portable angle guns, but they can't have many if they do. No place to put them."
"I see." Tiernier inhaled deeply. "Thank you, Sergeant. You've done well. Get back to your patrol and keep an eye on them."
"Yes, sir."
The non-com saluted, turned, and trotted back to the south, and Tiernier turned to Major Willems.
"Thoughts?"
"Beats the Shanwei out of me, sir," Willems said frankly. "It's not good news they're north of the river, though, that's for sure. Do you think they've taken Mayhem?"
"I don't know what I think."
Tiernier drummed the fingers of his right hand on the pommel of his saddle while he considered.
"There shouldn't be any Carisians north of the river. On the other hand, the sergeant seems pretty confident there are only 200 or 300 of them. Somehow I doubt the heretics would have the equivalent of a couple of our companies swanning around up here on their own."
"Oh," he stopped drumming to wave his hand, "if they've got the manpower to take back Midhold, it'd make sense for them to do it. That's why the Bishop Militant has us out here in the first place. But no matter how hard I try, I can't quite convince myself they'd be stupid enough to stick a force that small out on its own to get the chop."
He removed his helmet and ran his fingers through his hair, frowning thoughtfully for most of a minute. Then he squared his shoulders and nodded.
"The only way to find out what's going on is to go look. The sergeant's right about how flat the terrain is, so it's not like they could hide another couple of thousand men to jump on us. And if they don't have artillery, they've got to be feeling a little nervous. I'm going to assume they do have some of those small angle guns of theirs, whether the sergeant saw them or not. But as far as I know, their gunners have never tried to use them with 500 or 600 cavalry coming straight at them. I imagine that might shake their aim a bit."
"So you're planning an attack, sir?"
"I'm not attacking anything unless I think I can kick its ass,"
Tiernier said frankly.
"It's not my job to get a lot of our lads killed gloriously. It's my job to find out what's going on and report it to Bishop Quentin at Allenton. That doesn't mean I'll pass up the opportunity to run over those bastards if it offers itself, though."
His smile was bleak.
"We all want some of our own back after Cerebor. More to the point, any prisoners we take will tell the bishop everything he wants to know by the time the question's through with them."
"Yes, sir."
Willem's smile was even colder than Tiernier's.
"We're not going to do anything without making sure Bishop Quentin will be fully informed if it should happen something goes wrong," Tiernier continued. "Go inform Colonel Palmer that I intend to advance, observe the situation, and, assuming conditions appear favorable, attack. And while you're doing that, send couriers to Colonel Barristier and also directly to Allenton. Inform them that we've confirmed the presence of Carisian regulars in Midhold, north of the Mountain Cross River, and that I'll be sending additional reports as more information becomes available."
"I sure do hope the Major isn't being overly clever about this," Lieutenant Abraham Mazingale murmured as he watched the Army of God cavalry. "It wasn't the Major's brainstorm," Lieutenant Truman Dunstan replied from the corner of his mouth. The youthful lieutenant stood just below the crest of the small hill, although in their opinion calling such a miserable elevation a hill maligned a perfectly respectable noun, the standard of Company A, 2nd Battalion, 3rd Regiment, Imperial Carizian Army had been planted atop that hill by Major Carter Naismith, Company A's commanding officer. Mazingale commanded the company's 2nd Platoon, while Dunstan commanded 1st Platoon, and their men happened to be deployed along the eastern face of their hill, waiting to find out what the Temple boys had in mind. "It was Baron Greenvalley himself, I heard," Dunstan continued. "Really?" Mazingale perked up, and Dunstan smiled crookedly. The men of 2nd Brigade, for that matter, the men of the entire Imperial Carizian Army, had enormous faith in Greenvalley's judgment. His ability to read a tactical situation was almost as legendary as Emperor Caleb's ability to do the same thing at sea, and he constantly pounded home the need to husband manpower carefully when he critiqued training maneuvers. Both those qualities tended to reassure people he sent to do risky things that he planned on getting as few as possible of them killed, and probably knew what he was doing when he sent them out. Probably. Even Emperor Caleb had made mistakes upon occasion, after all. Still, some things were less likely than others. And the Baron had better have it right this time, Dunstan reflected. Company A had been deliberately parked in its exposed position, with only half its organic mortar platoon in support, when the mounted scout snipers came galloping back to Mayhem with word that enemy cavalry was headed that way. There could be several reasons for that, but the one that struck Dunstan as most likely was that Baron Greenvalley wanted to tempt the Temple boys into attacking them, and figured even they'd be smart enough to leave a full battalion supported by field guns alone. Dunstan had no objection to engaging the Army of God. Any awe he might have felt for the Temple boys had been pretty thoroughly laid to rest during the advance from Cerebor to Wyvern Lake. And Duke Eastshire had kicked arse and taken names along the Divan, too. The lieutenant would prefer, however, to have something like at least equal odds, and at the moment the odds looked distinctly unequal.
"Be damned, sir," Major Willems observed. "They are standing there with their bare asses blowing in the wind, aren't they?"
"So it would appear," Tierney replied, peering through his spyglass. The sergeant's numerical estimate seemed to be pretty much spot on. The reports he'd read suggested that an Imperial Carizian Army company was about twice the size of an Army of God infantry company, and he saw a single standard atop the hill. So call it between 200 and 230 men. And there were no field guns anywhere around. The sergeant had also been correct in his estimate that the heretics couldn't possibly have crammed more than a half dozen of their small angle guns into the available space, and the patrol which had been left to keep an eye on them while the sergeant reported back had seen no evidence the heretics were trying to reinforce this isolated detachment. On the other hand, they weren't trying to withdraw it either, which Tyrnir damned well would have been doing in their place. Assuming he could, that was.
"Somehow they must have gotten across the river and then been stuck on this side," he decided, lowering the spyglass and pursing his lips pensively. "But how? The scouts have swept all the way to the riverbank now without seeing any boats on this side. Maybe they got across on the ferry and sent it back to Mayhem for reinforcements? But if they did, why hasn't anyone joined them? Unless..." "I think they did attack Mayhem," he said slowly. "I never did put much faith in that 40 or 50,000 business, but the heretics might have sent a force smaller than that after the Mayhem locks. If they did, they were probably hoping for surprise, but Tolliver obviously knew they were coming, since he got his messengers off to Briscoe and Colonel Palmer. It's possible, maybe even probable, they managed to push him out of the town anyway. He didn't have that many men, unfortunately. And if the heretics did take the town, they probably took the ferry, too, which would explain how these fellows wound up on our side of the river. And why didn't they fall back on Mayhem when they spotted us, sir? I've been wondering that myself, and I think it's possible Tolliver may have managed to counterattack.
I don't think he was able to retake the town, though. In fact, if my suspicions are accurate, any counterattack's been beaten off by now. There's certainly no fighting going on over there at this point, anyway. I know the river's too broad for anyone to make out much in the way of details on the other side, but I'm pretty sure our scouts would be able to see powder smoke and hear gunfire if anyone was still engaged. It's possible he did manage to retake it, and that's why the fighting's over, but I think it's more likely he only managed to burn the ferry and strand these bastards over there. If so, that's pretty good news.
Good news, sir?
Well, the best we could expect, anyway. Tyrnir grimaced. If they came up the canal, they brought barges with them, Arthur. And if they had barges on the river, they could have used them to pull these people back. Or, assuming they weren't going to pull back, to reinforce them. So obviously they don't have barges on the river, and the only reason that would be true is that Tolivir managed to blow the locks.
I see. The Major nodded slowly, his expression thoughtful, and Tyrnir methodically hung the spyglass back across his shoulder. He gazed at the infantry on the hill for a moment longer, then inhaled sharply.
"What matters at the moment, though," he said more briskly, "is that they are stuck on our side of the river, and we've got them outnumbered 3-1. I think we ought to see about making them properly welcome, don't you?"
"All right, boys." Captain Dustin Baker's voice was level, almost soft, like that of a man soothing a skittish thoroughbred. "It looks like they're forming up. You'd think they'd know better than to charge formed infantry, but their cavalry's used the fire wing against the Sidomarkians, so they might try that here too instead."
"I wish they would be stupid enough to try that against Mondrain, sir," Lieutenant Marzingale said almost wistfully, and Baker chuckled.
"Well, they wouldn't head this way if they didn't intend to try something, Aubrey. And if it's just the same to you, I don't think we'll let them tempt us into charging them."
All four of the captain's platoon commanders chuckled, and he nodded.
"Looks like they're about ready. Get back to your men and tell them I want these people's asses kicked up between their sorry ears."
Walkir Tyrnir rode forward, trotting out in front of his regiment to consider its alignment. His men were no longer the spotlessly attired cavalrymen with gleaming accoutrements who'd set out from Zion so many months before. Their uniforms were shabby, their armor scuffed, the leather of saddles and tack worn, but their originally natty appearance had been replaced by a certain scruffy toughness. They were veterans, lean down and hardened, although they'd had precious little opportunity to execute the sort of tactics in which they'd originally trained. Tyrnir was proud of them, and as he gazed at them, he was conscious of his own eagerness to employ them the way they'd been meant to be employed. Here and there he saw troopers checking the priming on the pairs of double-barreled saddle pistols they'd been trained to use for the fire wing, which would have been called a caracol on a planet called Old Earth. The tactic had become possible only since the invention of the flintlock pistol, but it had been used effectively several times against Sidomarkian heretics by Bishop Militant Connor's cavalry during his advance out of Westmarch into Cliff Peak. Dalaran cavalry had used it successfully in the South March as well, but no one had yet attempted against Carizian heretics, and Tyrnir had his doubts about how well it would work in their case. The fire wing called for cavalry to ride directly towards the enemy at a half gallop, several ranks deep. As each rank entered pistol range, it turned sharply to the left or right so its riders could each discharge one pistol into the enemy, then turned sharply in the other direction so that he could fire a second pistol before swinging away to clear the range for the next oncoming rank. The idea was to deluge the enemy with a close-range, rolling hail of pistol fire, which would, in theory, disorder his formation, at which point the solid block of lancers coming on behind the pistoliers would smash straight through the wavering line. Experience had shown it worked, as at Ivanston, under the right conditions, but the Sidomarkian regiments against which the fire wing had succeeded had been pike regiments, their missile troops equipped only with arbalests or smoothbore matchlocks.
These were Carisian regulars, which meant they were equipped with rifles. Pistol fire would be a poor match for rifle fire, even if he did have twice as many men and each of his pistols did have two barrels. On the other hand, unlike the Sidermarkians, they didn't have pikes, and if they actually fired their rifles, they'd take even their bayonets out of play while they reloaded. Besides, that formation lacked the dense, deep ranks to present the forest of pikeheads that had made the Sidermarkian army so deadly against cavalry. It had to be far more fragile than the pike blocks which had bested Desnaire so often, and that made this a time to take a lesson from the past and use his armored lancers to deliver the classic decisive shock attack that broke infantry and then rode down the survivors. He considered the distance between his regiments and the heretics. 800 yards, he estimated. The Carisians were visible only as elongated forms, the details of uniform and body shape blurred by distance, although he could make out an occasional extended arm as an officer or a non-com gestured in his direction. That was plenty of distance to build speed, and the flat cropland was ideal terrain. Call it 50 yards at a walk, another 50 at a slow trot, 100 at a maneuvering trot, 200 at a maneuvering gallop, and the last 400 at the charge. 2.5 minutes total, and barely 50 seconds to cross the final 400 yards where rifle fire was likely to be effective. A muzzle-loading rifle would do well to get off 2 shots in that interval, especially one encumbered by the fixed bayonet which always slowed reloading, and any infantryman who didn't fix his bayonet in the face of a cavalry charge was a dead man. The heretics' breech-loading rifles were almost certain to do better than that, but they had to maintain an all-around facing if they didn't want him to curl around an exposed flank. That meant there were scarcely 70 rifles actually facing his men. Even if each of them got off 3 rounds, not 2, that was only 200. And he didn't care if they were Carisians. A lot of them were going to miss, rifles or not, with 600 cavalry coming right down their throats. And when they realized their rifle fire wasn't going to stop the charge after all. He nodded once, crisply, then trotted back to the 16th Standard and looked at the bugler.
Sound advance.
The notes of the AOG's bugles rose high, golden, and sweet, and more than one of the waiting Carisians swallowed hard as that mass of horsemen stirred, shifted, and started forward. The 16 companies of cavalry were formed into 8 lines, each 75 yards across and 3 yards deep. Combined with the 2-yard interval between lines, the formation stretched the next best thing to 40 yards from front to back, and its frontage was twice Company A's. It began to move slowly, but it gathered speed with a sort of stately majesty, churning dust into the warm September air. Early afternoon sunlight flickered as 600 lances came down, and a fresh bugle call sent the cavalry from a slow trot to something just short of a gallop. The sound of hooves was an approaching thunder, and then the bugle sounded once more, and the thunder accelerated yet again.
"Steady, boys, steady,"
Company A's platoon sergeant said.
"Wait for the word. Wait for it. We'll tell you when it's time."
Aside from that, there was silence on the Carisians' hill, and the same sun that gleamed on the Army of God lanceheads glittered on Carisian bayonets. The bugles sounded yet again as the range fell to 400 yards and the horses stretched into a full gallop across the table-flat cropland. That was still long range for aimed rifle fire, even for Carisian infantry with tangent sights, and so they waited, letting the range fall still further, obeying their sergeants, and waiting, waiting.
Fire!
The range was 200 yards, and the half-inch bullets hit their targets like Shanwei's sledgehammers. Horses screamed and went down. Here and there men flew out of their saddles, their plate cuirasses woefully insufficient to turn those massive bullets, yet the charge never hesitated.
A few horses stumbled over fallen fellows, crashing to the ground, rolling over their riders, leaving gaps in the lines. But most of them avoided the obstacles, the gaps closed up, and the survivors were galloping at over 400 yards per minute.
Fire!
A second volley crashed home with even more accuracy, creating bigger holes in the tight formation, and the bugles were sounding, driving the 16th and 53rd Cavalry towards the enemies of God and the archangels on the wings of the jihad.
Holy Langhorne and no quarter!
Both regiments took up the cry, riding with it in their ears, eyes hard and hating as the enemies of God came into their reach.
Fire!
A third volley roared, and 30% of the 16th Cavalry was down, dead, or wounded. But the survivors leaned forward, lances at the thrust, screaming their war cries, with the 53rd right behind them.
Present bayonets!
Those glittering bayonets steadied, presenting a thicket of steel, and Colonel Tierner's battle plan came apart. The great romantic fallacy of cavalry warfare was that cavalry charged, that its effectiveness lay in mounted men's ability to ride down infantry, ramming home an attack with cold steel, driven by all the weight and momentum of horse and rider alike. That heavy horse shattered infantry by the sheer, ferocious impact of its charge. But cavalry didn't charge. Not the way the bards described it, because horses were not fools, nor were they predators. They were herbivores, herd animals, the natural prey of predators, and their primary defense against threats was to run away from them, not towards them. They could be trained to carry men they trusted towards a threat, but that changed none of their basic instincts, nor did it change physics. A 700 or 800 pound horse moving at 15 or 16 miles per hour would suffer significant, even catastrophic damage if it collided with a solid obstacle a quarter of its own weight. Horses' legs were fragile, designed to withstand the vertical shock of trotting or galloping, but not the lateral shearing stresses when they collided at speed with another body, human or equine, and cavalry mounts knew it. Galloping horses didn't attempt to avoid fallen humans out of the goodness of their hearts. They did it because they knew how badly they could be injured if they tripped over those humans. And as anyone who ever attempted to train a horse for the steeplechase quickly learned, they would refuse to jump even light wooden rails or hay bales if they thought the barricade was too tall. In point of fact, the highest obstacle allowed in steeplechase events was only 5 feet, and the obstacle in front of these horses, who were not steeplechasers and had not the slightest interest in becoming steeplechasers, averaged over 5.5 feet tall. It was also fringed with nasty, sharp bayonets. At the Battle of Waterloo, on distant, long-dead old earth, Marshal Ney's French cuirassers launched charge after charge upon the British infantry squares, uselessly. Because the truth was that throughout history, shock cavalry depended not upon physical shock, but on the moral shock of a man on foot facing several tons of mounted, usually armored horsemen charging straight at him in a drum roll of hoof-pounding thunder. While it was true that a charging horse would be badly injured if it slammed headlong into a human being, it was a given that the much smaller human would fare at least as badly, and that didn't even count the usually better-armored lunatic on the horse's back, who was bound to be waving around a sword, or, even worse, a long, pointy lance. The natural reaction when faced by such an obvious threat was the same sensible response horses favored when faced by predators: run away. But infantry that didn't run away, infantry that held its ground, discovered those same horses' disinclination to ram headlong into a dangerous obstacle. Horses would cheerfully pursue a fleeing enemy. They were even willing to charge other horses and let the maniacs on their backs hack and hew at one another to their heart's content.
As long as both formations were open enough, they might hope to find a way through. But bayonet-armed infantrymen standing shoulder to shoulder, with no nice horse-wide gaps between them? Never. In conjunction with artillery or the musketry of supporting infantry, cavalry could be devastating against that sort of target. A formation solid enough to repel a cavalry charge was an ideal target for small arms, round shot, grape shot, or canister. If the infantry stood in solid ranks, it suffered massive casualties. If it adopted a more open formation to minimize its fire casualties, it became easy meat for the horsemen. Unfortunately for the Army of God, it had no artillery or supporting infantry, and its horses, their ears already full of the screams of other wounded and dying horses, refused to break their legs or their necks against that solid, unshaken, bayonet-bristling wall of infantry.
Second rank, independent targets. Third rank, grenades!
The second line of infantry opened fire once more, using their weapons' breech-loading capability to maintain the threat of their bayonets even as they reloaded. They chose their targets and fired. And the line behind them pulled the lanyards and heaved smoking showers of hand grenades over the heads of their fellows and into the cavalry beyond. Explosions thundered, spewing hundreds of round lead bullets, and the shrieks of wounded horses rose like hideous music. The bugle was still sounding across the bedlam of shots, shrieks, screams, and explosions, but then a grenade or a bullet found the bugler, and the martial melody died with the player.
Mortar platoon, engage!
The 6 3-inch mortars in the pits at the very apex of the hill began to cough, sending 10-pound projectiles into the farthest portions of the AOG formation. They were impact-fused, exploding as they hit the ground, throwing their own sheets of shrapnel balls to join the hand grenades. It lasted 11 minutes from the moment the two cavalry regiments accelerated to a full gallop. 1 minute to reach the Carizian front line, 3 minutes of shrieking madness in a cauldron of devastation, and 7 minutes for the terrified survivors to get out of range of the vengefully pursuing mortar bombs, time-fused now, to shower the deadly cones of shrapnel from above. Of the 619 cavalrymen who began that charge, 253, an astonishingly high number, really, and almost half of them still with horses, survived to fall back in its wreckage. Colonel Walker Turner and Major Arthur Willems were not among them. Chapter 8. HMS Powerful, 58, Jaris Island, Gulf of Jaris, Desnarian Empire.
Be seated, gentlemen.
The dozen senior captains and commanders in Admiral Pater Shane's day cabin settled into chairs around the round, polished table. Jack Hawkins, Shane's flag captain and HMS Powerful's commanding officer, sat directly across from his admiral and laid a folder on the tabletop in front of him. Sunlight through the cabin's windows sent patterns dancing across the low overhead as it reflected off the waves while the ship lay to her anchors off Jaris Island. The Imperial Carizian Navy had seized the island, little more than a vast sheep farm, 5 miles across, as an advanced base in the gulf of the same name. The shepherds who lived on it had been too wise to offer any resistance, and they'd been astonished to learn that the invaders actually intended to pay for the sheep they carried off. The island offered a source of water and a good holding ground for anchors, but precious little more. Still, it was a place where men could go ashore, stretch their legs, and get a little exercise, and the mutton made a worthwhile addition to their normal rations. The skylight was open, as were the quarter windows, admitting what breeze there was. There wasn't a great deal of it, which was unfortunate, since the day was blisteringly hot, as might be expected less than 70 miles above the equator.
Shane's servant bustled about, making certain each of his guests had a filled glass, then bowed his way out with smooth efficiency.
"I don't expect the subject of today's meeting to come as a vast surprise to any of you," Shane said with a slight smile as he picked up his own wine glass. He sipped appreciatively and leaned back in his chair.
"Our orders have arrived. We'll commence active operation throughout the Gulf the day after tomorrow, with instructions to take, burn, or sink everything we find, with special emphasis on privateers and the shipyards building them."
His smile grew broader and colder as he let their stir of reaction circle the table before he continued.
"The delay," he said then, "was occasioned by our wait for our latest arrivals."
He gestured gracefully to where Captain Simon Masterson, the commanding officer of HMS Rottweiler, sat side by side with Captain Brixton Abernethy, HMS Earthquake CO.
"I expect they'll make themselves useful."
Abernethy was one of the increasing number of ICN officers who'd grown to adulthood as the subjects of someone other than King Harald of Caris. In fact, he was a Taroisian, which still inclined some old Carisian officers to be prejudiced against him, given King Gorgia III's betrayal and the Group of Four's initial attack on the Kingdom of Caris. Shane wasn't one of them, partly because he realized Abernethy, who'd served as a lieutenant aboard one of the few galleys to escape the battles off Armageddon Reef, had had no choice but to obey the orders of his lawful superiors. And if Shane was going to be completely honest, partly because his emperor and empress had made it very, very clear that not just Chisomians, but Emeraldians, Taroisians, and even Zebedians were all Carisians now. Their officers and enlisted personnel were to be treated accordingly, and Pater Shane, who had a closer acquaintance with both his monarchs than many a serving officer, was far too wise to argue with them. There were still relatively few non-Carisians or Chisomians in command of major warships, but that was primarily because there'd been fewer senior officers in any of the Carisian Empire's other member states when they became member states. Numbers were growing, however, and non-old Carisians were becoming more and more thoroughly integrated into the junior officer corps. Within another few years, there'd be plenty of Taroisian and Emeraldian accents in a meeting like this one. For now, however, Abernethy's arrival had been particularly opportune, since Earthquake was one of the Angle-gun-armed bombardment ships. Her high-trajectory firepower would be a welcome addition when it came time to engage the batteries the Desnarians had erected to protect the bays and inlets where their shipyards were busily building the privateers which came swarming out of the Gulf of Jaras, despite all Commodore Russell Tierner's overworked blockaders could do. Tierner was intercepting at least 50% of them from his base on Howard Island, but once a privateer got to sea, there were countless ports along the Desnarian, Delphirakan, Harchongese, and Dalaran coasts where she and her sisters could find safe harbor and continue the increasingly intense pressure on Carisian maritime commerce. The majority of the Desnarian shipbuilding capacity remained concentrated in the Gulf of Jaras, however. Burning out the privateers at the source would be far more economical than trying to hunt them down once they'd gotten to sea, and Earthquake was just the sledgehammer for the task. Masterson's command was quite a different breed of Kraken. His ship had been the brainchild of High Admiral Locke Island, whose sense of humor had led him to name her in honor of Keelhaul, the huge Rottweiler who'd been his constant companion. And like Keelhaul, this Rottweiler was big, tough, and dangerous, despite the fact that she mounted only 30 guns. She'd been designed to carry no less than 88 guns as a unit of the Thunderer class. New developments, like the shell-firing cannon, had supervened, however, and Locke Island had ordered Rottweiler and her first five sisters cut down to a single gun deck. The result was a tremendous flush-decked galleon. At 195 feet, she was the longest galleon ever built, 20 feet longer and 8 feet broader than even the Sword of Caris class, with only 15 gun ports on a side. She retained her original sail plan, which made her extremely fast, and the weight saved by removing two entire gun decks worth of height had allowed the shipyards to armor her with 3-inch steel plates backed by almost 3 feet of solid Carisian teak. Her armor covered her sides from weather deck to 3 feet below the waterline, where its thickness tapered to 1.5 inches. Yet with the reduction in top weight, she was still able to show 15 feet of freeboard, which meant she could work her guns in even the roughest weather. Only the fact that Sir Dustin Olivier had adopted diagonal planking and used iron bolts between frames to increase their longitudinal strength let the converted ships carry the weight of their armor without catastrophic hogging. And even so, it was probably thinner than Olivier and his designers would have preferred. Nor did it do anything to protect her masts and rigging. Despite that, she and her sisters, two more had already joined the fleet, and a third would commission within the next month or so, were the best-protected blue water warships ever to sail the seas of Safehold. They were, in fact, the only blue water warships protected against the shellfire. That would have been enough to make her a much-appreciated addition to any squadron likely to encounter well-dug-in shore batteries, but protection was far from the only thing she brought to the fight. She might mount only 30 guns, but unlike the standard 30-pounders most Carisian galleons carried, they were 6-inch rifled angle guns mounted on 2-wheeled Mondrain broadside carriages. There had been some concern that using studded shells would slow rate of fire unacceptably in a broadside gun, but tests had reassured the warriors. Using the new carriages, her gunners were able to more than match the rate of fire from ships armed with the old-style carriages and hold their own even against other galleons with Mondrains. The greater accuracy of a rifled shell was of less value to naval gunners, whose firing platforms and targets tended to move in several dimensions at once in anything other than a dead calm, but the elongated shell's greater range, weight, penetration capability, and much more powerful bursting charges gave her guns enormous hitting power.
"I can see where waiting for Rottweiler and Earthquake made sense, sir," Captain Timothy Tiernier said. "But there's still one thing that worries me just a bit, and that's the little matter of finding people to shoot at."
Several people chuckled. Tiernier, the commander of HMS Valiant and one of Shane's senior captains, was a direct, hard-headed officer. He was also an Emeraldian, with a stocky build, slightly less than average height, and a dry sense of humor. Despite his tone's ironic whimsy, however, the question was serious, and well taken. With over 2,000 miles of coastline, the Gulf of Jaras offered hundreds of places shipyards capable of building schooners or brigs could be quietly established. Shane commanded a squadron of 12 galleons, 20 naval brigs and schooners, Rottweiler, Earthquake, and a handful of store ships. If all of his warships had been stationed in a line in clear weather, their lookouts could have covered roughly 14,000 square miles of seawater, which sounded like a lot, but it would have amounted to little more than a rectangle 630 miles long and 20 miles wide. Even if he'd been prepared to operate his ships as singletons, he could have kept less than a third of the Gulf of Jaras's coastline under observation at any given moment.
"I take your point, Timothy," he said. "I do, however, have something a bit more subtle in mind than simply sailing around in the middle of the Gulf in hopes the privateers will be sufficiently angered by our presence to sail out to the attack."
The chuckles were louder this time, and Tiernier smiled. Shane smiled back, then allowed his expression to sober.
"The other thing we've been waiting for," he went on, "was a report from our spies. Actually, I suspect it's from Sajin Merlin and his spies."
The amusement of a moment before was suddenly muted. The officers in his day cabin were senior enough to have been exposed to the detailed reliability of reports from Merlin Othrawis's astounding network of agents. Most of them, Shane knew, suspected, as he did himself, that many of those agents were also Sajins.
"We have a list of building and fitting out locations, which, as of approximately 2 5 days ago, was as complete and accurate as our spies could make it," he told them. Obviously, we can't rely on it as holy writ, but I think we'll be able to find someone for you to shoot at, Timothy.
That suits me right down to the ground, sir, Tierney told him.
Even with that information in hand, we're going to have quite a lot of work for fellows like you, Commander Slovak,
Shane continued, turning to one of the more junior officers present. His HMS Termagant was an 18-gun schooner, fleet, fast, maneuverable, and easily as powerful as any of the privateers being built around the Gulf. The young man sat a bit straighter, and Shane smiled.
In addition to burning out this modest nest of privateers, His Majesty's instructions to take, burn, or sink apply to any Desnarian shipping foolish enough to attempt to cross the Gulf, Padro. I'm sending Termagant, King Wyvern, and Falcon to keep an eye on Marossa Bay. You'll be the senior officer in command, and I don't want you entering the bay itself without heavier support. I also don't want any coasters making it out of the bay until we get around to bringing you that support, however. Yes, sir.
The youngster's eyes gleamed, and Shane considered adding another word or two of caution. Pydro Slovak was only 27 and possessed of a naturally aggressive nature. That could be a potentially dicey combination, but he also had almost 15 years of experience at sea, despite his youth. Besides, aggressiveness was a precious commodity in a naval officer.
Eventually, the Admiral said instead, looking around the table once more, we'll move the blockade inside Marossa Bay itself. With any luck, we'll be able to shut down the east end of the Marossa Canal completely. I'd like to land raiding parties to blow up the locks, but Marossa's a major town with a garrison to match, so I'll settle for putting them out of action with Captain Abernethy's angle guns. Even if we do, we won't be able to keep them from offloading the barges farther west and sending them up the coast by wagon. But according to our best information, the high road between Marossa and Hondril's more of a pious hope than a reality, whatever the maps show. And for that matter, Hondril's a lot smaller than Marossa, and it isn't supposed to be heavily fortified or garrisoned. That may change once we start burning things down around the entire coast of the Gulf, of course. If it doesn't, though, I'm going to think very seriously about seizing Hondril outright.
One or two of his officers looked thoughtful in response to his last sentence, he noticed.
I know our marine contingents have been pared to the bone to support operations in the Republic, he told them, and I don't propose to get excessively adventurous. As His Majesty said on occasion, an adventure is someone else being cold, wet, hungry, frightened, and miserable far, far away from you, and I'm no fonder of getting personally involved with them than the next man.
This time several people laughed outright, and he allowed himself a grin.
Nonetheless, if we can take Hondril, we cut the only so-called high road east of the Mercia Mountains, and that effectively cuts overland communication from Marossa all the way to Silkia. With our squadron in control of the Gulf, all their supplies would have to go overland west of the mountains, through North Watch, or down the Hanke and Alton rivers, and then across Hanke Sound. At the very least, I imagine they'd find our presence there just a bit of a distraction, and we might be able to turn it into a sort of vest-pocket Thesmar when they try to do something about it. If nothing else, we could make them divert the resources to do something about us in Handril, and then just sail away, laughing down our sleeves after they do.
This time the thoughtful expression seemed less concerned with their flag officer's sanity than with the merits of his proposal, he observed.
That's for the future, however. At the moment, Captain Hawkins and I have been giving some thought to more immediately pressing objectives. I'll let him lay out the fruits of our labor, and then we'll see what sort of insightful improvements you lot can come up with. Jack?
Of course, Admiral.
Captain Hawkins smiled.
Not that this bunch of idle layabouts is really likely to improve upon our own brilliant analysis. Still, I suppose it would be only polite to give them the opportunity.
That was my own thought, Shane agreed gravely, although I was far too tactful to say it.
Laughter rumbled again, and Hawkins opened the folder in front of him.
Given the information we've received, Calais is probably the best place to begin. We already knew they were building privateers there, but according to our spies, we were wrong in at least one regard. Calais' artillery hasn't been upgraded.
It's all still old model guns, most without even welded trunnions, and there's no indication the Desnarians will be able to change that situation with so much of their foundry capacity devoted to their army. Hitting Calais first will give us an opportunity to get the squadron accustomed to working together and test our tactics before we go up against a tougher target. After that, we thought...
Chapter 9. Sidar City, Republic of Sidarmark. It was noisy inside the converted waterfront warehouse. Things tended to be that way when hammers were sounding on anvils, dozens of men were trying to communicate with one another, hand-powered bellows were fanning forges, rain pounded on the roof, and every so often someone dumped what sounded like a ton or so of scrap metal on a stone floor. Clement Abercrombie was used to the noise. In fact, he was used to considerably worse noise. What he wasn't used to was the trio of Marine guards walking behind him, each armed with one of the new cap-and-ball revolvers Sajan Merlin had introduced in addition to his slung rifle. He paused just inside the door, looking for the man he'd come here to find. It was sufficiently smoky and crowded to complicate what ought to have been a relatively simple task, and he sighed and slicked rainwater off the bald spot about which his wife and both of his sisters had teased him unmercifully for the last 3 years. His father still had a full head of distinguished-looking silver hair at 63, and it seemed particularly unjust that Clement should be going bald before he reached half that age. Of course, there was a lot of injustice going around these days. Abercrombie's jaw tightened, and he rubbed the knuckle of his left index finger over what would have been called his walrus mustache back on old Earth as the memory rolled through him. Sidarmarkians had always gotten along better with Carizians than the majority of mainlanders. Indeed, that was one reason Jaspar Clinton's suspicion of Sidarmark's orthodoxy had been so compulsive, and Carizians and Sidarmarkians had been intermarrying for generations, despite the weary miles of seawater between them. In fact, Abercrombie had relatives right here in Sidar City. Unfortunately, he had two less than he'd had before the Sword of Schuller. His 12-year-old cousin, Frederica, had been raped and murdered when the Temple Loyalist mob attacked the Carizian quarter, and his uncle Justin had died attempting to protect his daughter from her killers. He'd been unarmed. That was how great the surprise had been, and by all accounts there'd been at least 7 attackers, but he'd managed to kill at least one of them while his daughter's screams rang in his ears. Afterward, they'd mutilated both bodies, flung them into a smashed and looted shop, and set fire to the place, whether to hide the evidence of their crimes or to deface their victims still further was more than Abercrombie could say. His Aunt Lisbeth was still trying to understand how her own countrymen could have done such things, and Abercrombie often thought that only the need to somehow keep her other 2 children alive through the winter of privation which had followed had kept Lisbeth Segale sane. Or as sane as anyone could be under the circumstances. Unlike his aunt, however, Abercrombie understood how it had happened. He understood that the darkness that lived inside most human beings was stronger and darker in some, and he understood that things like his cousin's horrible death were inevitable when the corrupt, lying piece of kraken shit in the Grand Inquisitor's chair gave that darkness the stamp of God's own approval. And just as he understood that, he understood how someone like Clinton and the actions he endorsed could lead other men to embrace the sin of hatred and the hot thirst for vengeance. That was why he'd jumped at the chance when Edward Hausman needed volunteers for the technical mission to the Republic. Clement Abercrombie had never thought of himself as the godliest of men, even before the Sword of Schuller. He did his best, but he'd also been aware his best fell short of what God and the archangels truly desired from their children. On the other hand, Mother Church had always taught there was absolution for any sin, as long as the penitence was genuine, the contrition was real, and the sinner truly sought to amend his life in the future. He fully intended to seek that absolution as soon as the last temple loyalist in the Republic of Sidermark had choked out his last maggot-ridden breath at the end of a rope. He inhaled deeply and forced himself to put that thought aside as he finally spotted the person he'd been seeking.
"This way, Corporal,"
he said, and the senior member of his escort nodded, then twitched his head at the pair of privates, and the three of them followed him across that crowded, noisy floor. Abercrombie nodded to those he knew, stopping to speak to several of them. He wasn't in that big a hurry, and it was a major part of his responsibilities as Brigham Carter's assistant to keep his finger on the pulse of workshops like this one. There were several processes underway on the busy floor, but the biggest single activity was the conversion of Sidermark-made muzzle-loading flintlocks to take percussion caps. A third of the conversion work was being done by the trained armorers who'd arrived with the second echelon of the Carisian Expeditionary Force to set up the CEF's rear area repair shops. For the most part, though, they were serving in the instructor's role, teaching Sidermarkians, not all of them gunsmiths, a fact Abercrombie knew that irritated the Gunmakers Guild no end, to perform the same task. Similar instruction was going on all across the workshop. Abercrombie wasn't sure it was the most effective way to improve the Republic's manufacturing efficiency, but it was the policy which had been adopted, and he grasped the underlying logic. Carisian manufactories held a huge margin of superiority when it came to speed and quality of production, and it must have been extremely tempting to Emperor Caleb and Empress Charlian to export that same capability to Sidermark. Unfortunately, they couldn't do that. Not overnight, at any rate. It was difficult enough to create the same sorts of manufactories in Chisholm, and the unvarnished truth was that it was more important to continue building that capability throughout the Empire than it was to create it here on the mainland. If Sidermark fell after all, Karis would have to fight on alone, and she'd require every scrap of capacity she could find for that. So the decision had been taken to send advisors, technical missions, as the Emperor and Empress called them, to assist the Sidermarkians in building their own manufactories, but not to divert thousands of trained workers to get those Sidermarkian manufactories up and running. And the Republic understood the logic, too. Chancellor Maiden and Lord Protector Gregor were concentrating on building up the ability to repair first and to manufacture second, in a division of labor that made the best use of Karis's steadily growing capabilities. Rifle and bayonet manufacture was a glaring exception to that rule, and the Lord Protector was pushing ahead with the construction of a major iron and steelworks of his own just outside Siddar City, using plans provided by the Delthak Works.
"Makes a lot of sense, really," Abercrombie thought. "This way he trains scads of workers, gets them accustomed to the new techniques and new ways of thinking before he puts up the manufactories he's going to need them to work in. It's just a damned pity we can't do everything at once."
He smiled wryly at the thought. He'd gotten so accustomed to watching Edward Hausman that it was sometimes hard to remember that other people couldn't do everything at once. He paused again, laying one hand on the shoulder of a Sidermarkian supervisor and exchanging a few words with the man, then, finally, found himself close enough to the man he'd been looking for to call his name.
"Zek! Yo, Zek!"
The wiry, dark, and very young ICN lieutenant turned and smiled as he recognized Abercrombie. Zek Barristeer held out one of his large, strong hands, with its calluses and ingrained oil and coal dust, and clasped forearms with his friend.
"Clement, I didn't expect to see you down here today." "I didn't expect to be down here today," Abercrombie replied with a grin. "But then I dropped by Delthak looking for you, and they told me you were over here. So I trudged the entire 300 yards from the dockyard to find you. I am smitten, smitten, I tell you, by your staunch devotion to duty." "And well you should be, especially since I was forced to subject not merely myself, but also Corporal Browning and his men to the arduous privation of our forced march." "My apologies, Corporal," Barristeer said dryly,
looking over Abercrombie's shoulder at the slightly taller Marine. "No problem, sir," Browning replied. He was a typical old Carisian, brown-haired and brown-eyed with a tanned complexion, and he had the solid, weathered look of a long-term professional soldier. Looking at the sleeve of his tunic, Barrister could just make out where a sergeant's stripes had been removed, and he wondered what Browning had done. Whatever it was, it clearly hadn't reflected any doubt about his capabilities if he'd been assigned to bodyguard Abercrombie. Of course, that raised another interesting question.
"Is there a reason the corporal has to go everywhere with you?"
"I'm afraid so," Abercrombie sighed.
"Do you remember George Truman?"
"I don't think so." Barrister searched his memory.
"Name doesn't ring any bells anyway. Why?"
"He was another member of Master Carter's staff."
"Was another member of Master Carter's staff?"
Barrister pounced on the verb tense, and Abercrombie nodded. "He was on his way to a conference with Master Artims last 5 days. There was a riot." Abercrombie's nostrils flared.
"George was killed." "I'm sorry to hear that."
Barrister rubbed his right eyebrow thoughtfully.
"I did hear about the riot, though. Over in Tanner's Way, wasn't it?"
"Yes.
We thought that was a relatively safe part of town, but it was too close to the docks, apparently. Or to the sailmaker's lofts, anyway."
Abercrombie grimaced.
"You know how those bastards blame us for all their problems."
Barrister nodded. It would have been foolish to expect skilled workers whose trades had been disordered by the new Carisian approach to producing goods not to resent Carus. Not that their resentment was going to change anything. They'd be far better employed, in Jacques Barrister's opinion, learning new trades or adapting to the ways in which their existing trades had changed. But that was probably expecting too much of human nature.
"Somebody realized George was a Carisian," Abercrombie said. "Or, and I think this is more likely, actually, they recognized the three men he was with as supervisors from Master Adams's foundry and figured out who George was from who he was keeping company with. Anyway, somebody started screaming about Carisian heretics snatching food out of the mouths of starving babes, and before anyone knew it, it was a full-bore riot. It spread across 2 or 3 square blocks before the city guard got on top of it, and at least 3 shops burned. At the end of it, the guard took up a right young bastard named Negale, Samuel Negale, found his knife still in George's back. But he swears he didn't do it, of course. Nobody believes him, and I'll be surprised if he doesn't hang within the 5 day.
One of Barrister's eyebrows rose at the bitterness of his tone. Anyone could be excused for taking a friend's death personally, but Abercrombie wasn't going to be surprised if this Negale stayed unhanged for another 5 day. He was going to be disappointed. Abercrombie recognized his expression and shrugged.
"Sorry. It's not just that the rancid little son of a bitch murdered George, Jack. Once the guard grabbed him, witnesses started coming out of the woodwork. It seems Negale spent the attack on the Carisian quarter torching shops and homes when he wasn't doing something worse. If there's anyone in this entire friggin' city who's overdue for a date with the hangman, it's him."
Barrister nodded. He couldn't disagree with the sentiment, assuming the testimony against Negale was truthful. And however he might feel about it, he understood exactly why Abercrombie would feel nothing but vengeful satisfaction when the executioner sprang the trap.
"Anyway, they've decided all of us heretical Carisian masterminds need bodyguards when we wander around the city,"
Abercrombie snorted.
"And if I have to have someone following me around, I could do worse than Aldous here."
"I see." Barrister looked at the corporal again.
"Master Abercrombie's a civilian, corporal," he said. "Mind you, he's always stuck me as a fairly smart civilian, but he's still a civilian who happens to be both a friend of mine and an asset to the Empire. Don't take any crap off of him when it all falls in the shitter. In fact, you have my direct order to hit him over the head and drag his unconscious ass out of the line of fire, if that's what it takes."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Browning jerked to attention and touched his chest in salute, and Abercrombie smiled. But then his smile faded as he realized both Barrister and Browning were absolutely serious.
"Jack,"
Clement, it isn't a game.
Barrister met his friend's eyes levelly.
I know you're not stupid enough to think it is a game, but it'd only take a heartbeat for someone to plant a dagger in your back. I'm perfectly willing to believe the riot that killed your friend was spontaneous. I'm equally prepared to believe it wasn't, and the fact that they've assigned you a permanent bodyguard suggests someone considerably senior to both of us has his own doubts about that spontaneity. If it wasn't spontaneous, if someone does try to add you to the bag, an instant of hesitation on your part or on Corporal Browning's could get you killed too. And I'm not going home to that pretty wife you've described to me to tell her it happened on my watch. Do you understand me? Yes, of course I do. Good. And now, Barristeer inhaled deeply. Just what brought you down to the waterfront seeking me out?
Well, actually, I was looking for Lieutenant Blondensburg first, but they told me he and Captain Barnes were off at some sort of conference, so that left you and Lieutenant Carneers. And since I know you, you're the lucky one.
Lucky exactly how?
Barristeer asked cautiously.
We're expecting a convoy from Tellisburg, and when it gets here, we're going to have to open Delphac's casemate like a cracker box. Somebody'll have to help the dockyard figure out how to do that. And guess who just got elected?
I beg your pardon?
Barrister stared at him, and Abercrombie chuckled a bit sourly.
We're going to need a rather large opening, he explained. It seems Master Hausman and Admiral Seamount, oh, and Captain Roscale, have completed work on the new 6-inch breech loader, and enough of the new guns and carriages are on their way to Sidar City to rearm your ship. And given all the other things we're rushing around doing, we're going to have Shan Wei's own time getting them mounted on schedule. So, since you're Delphac's engineer, in charge of all those stokers and seeing to all of those repairs and things, and since I'm sure you're going to be up to your elbows in grease getting these newfangled recoil systems to work the way they're supposed to, I thought it would be best if I just went ahead and warned you now that they were coming. You can expect them sometime early next 5 day.
Chapter 10 Imperial Palace, City of Cherraith, Kingdom of Chisholm, Empire of Chorus, and Carisian Embassy, Sidar City, Republic of Siddermark. The late afternoon was sunny and surprisingly mild, almost balmy, for late September in the Kingdom of Chisholm. The evening chill waited patiently behind that sunlight, but on such a golden day some of the 50,000 or so Imperial Carisian army troops aboard the vast convoy sailing out of Port Royal actually felt cheerful at the prospect of their voyage to Siddermark. Others, wiser or simply more experienced, were less cheery about the whole business. It was over 9,000 miles for a wyvern to Sidar City, and there were no wyverns. Worse, they'd be fighting headwinds the entire voyage. And worse still, they'd be crossing the body of water mariners had christened the Anvil. And not because it offered such pleasant opportunities for yachting. However glum some might be, however, the mood aboard the crowded transport vessels was primarily one of anticipation. The semaphore chain across Ravensland was carrying messages from the mainland once again, which reflected a sea change among the Raven Lords. And because it was, Chisholm knew how decisively the Imperial Army had halted the Army of God, which had swept to within 600 miles of Sidar City itself. The troops departing Port Royal on that sunny afternoon tide, under those clouds of sea wyverns and seabirds, sent on their way by the fortress's saluting guns, felt a fierce pride in their fellows, and an equally fierce satisfaction at the vindication of the radical new style of warfare in which they'd been trained. There was as much hatred as pride and determination aboard some of those transports, for the same semaphore messages had reported what had happened to Brigadier Tyson's men, just as they'd reported the atrocities, the concentration camps, the burned farms and villages, the dead civilians lying by the high road's verge, where starvation or disease had pulled them down. Temple loyalist sentiment in Chisholm had been stronger than in Old Chorus. Hardcore Temple loyalists had been a minority,
Yet reformists and pro-reformists had constituted a bare majority of the Chisholmian population before Queen Charlian married King Caleb. It was the depth of Chisholm's devotion to the child queen it had watched grow into a powerful monarch without ever losing her own devotion to the people of her realm which had carried the kingdom into support of the Church of Carus. That had been enough, especially after they met Emperor Caleb, decided he truly loved the queen they loved, and concluded that he was worthy of her. And yet even though the Chisholmian reformists embraced the need to reform Mother Church's abuses, Chisholm, as a whole, had possessed far less of the fiery ardor which gripped old Carus. Perhaps that was inevitable, since Chisholm had never been the object of an unprovoked assault engineered by the Church of God awaiting. Chisholm had lost heavily in lives and ships when it was forced to participate in that assault, however, and the more astute among Queen Charlian's subjects had realized that if Jaspar Clinton could destroy Carus merely because he suspected its orthodoxy, it was almost inevitable that he would break Chisholm to his bridle as well in the fullness of time. The murder of Gwilym Monthyr and his men had underscored the threat, and so Chisholm had given itself to the war against the Group of Four, prepared to play its part, to make the sacrifices demanded of it, but still without that spark of true fury, that sense of having met the monster face to face, stared into its maw, smelled the stench of its carrion breath. But the massacre of Brigadier Tyson's command, the torture and murder of entire armies, the starvation and death of millions, all at the orders of Jaspar Clinton, had hit the kingdom like a handful of gunpowder cast across dimly glowing coals. Those who'd been ambivalent saw suddenly the true difference between the two sides. Even many temple loyalists, especially among those who'd clung to their old faith out of habit and a natural suspicion of the forces of reform and change, had been shaken to the core, and quite a few of them had become reformists over the past few months. Inevitably, the temple loyalists who remained had become even more fiercely dedicated to the legitimate church, even though the crown specifically protected their right to worship in the manner of their choice. The savage denunciations of Jaspar Clinton and the Inquisition they heard daily forced them into a defensive posture that hunkered down, hunched its shoulders against the storm, and clung passionately to its faith. In fact, many of them flatly denied the reports from the Republic. They were, must be, lies created to vilify Mother Church's loyal sons. The keeper of men's souls must occasionally be stern, as the Book of Schuller commanded, but she would never murder children or condone rape, arson, and massacre on such a scale. Those who believed that were losing ground steadily, however, and the men of the Imperial Carisian Army, which had grown out of the Royal Chisholmian Army, had been staunchly devoted to the crown and to the empire long before the first Carisian boot stepped onto a Sidermarkian wharf. There were very few qualms aboard those ships, standing out from Port Royal into Kraken Bay. "Well, there they go," Caleb Armok said. It was 4 hours earlier in Sidar City, but sunset was coming sooner every day. It was already dark outside the windows of his embassy study, because unlike Port Royal's sky, the Sidermarkian capital's was anything but cloudless. Rain drummed on the embassy's roof, gurgling through downspouts and splashing on the paving, and the coal fire on his hearth was welcome.
"Yes, they do," his wife agreed from her own palace apartment in Charaith. She leaned back in a comfortable chair, holding a drowsy Princess Alana in her lap, while Sarai Halman guarded her privacy like a restless dragon. The Empress had been involved in one meeting after another since shortly after dawn, before she'd finally announced that she was spending the evening with her daughter. With Sergeant Seahamper outside her door and her personal maid poised to annihilate any member of the palace staff who even looked like intruding upon Her Majesty, she could be reasonably confident of her ability to converse with Caleb and their allies without interruption. And after a day like today, She needed that conversation. You do realize Whitecrag and Sir Alba are a lot more worried about sending the entire army to the Republic than they want to admit, don't you? Caleb asked now, and she snorted. Is there some reason you think I arrived in Chiraeth aboard this morning's turnip wagon? Of course they're worried. They're my first counselor and my spy master. It's their jobs to worry, Caleb. And they're not entirely wrong to either, Charlie, Merlin Athrawes put in. He was in his own room, arranged in the lotus position with his eyes closed. He'd taken to parking himself in that posture whenever he was officially meditating, and his ability to remain inhumanly still for hours on end, motionless, scarcely even breathing, had polished his official persona as mystic warrior quite nicely. No one looking at him could have guessed from his serene expression what was passing through his mind, but his voice over the comm carried an edge of concern he would have allowed very few people to hear. The more fervent they get and the more isolated they feel, the more likely someone like Countess Swale or Duke Rockcoast is to do something stupid, he went on. And this is the first time since your father took the throne that virtually the entire army's been out of the kingdom. I realize that. Charlian's voice was far more serene than Merlin's. And before you or Caleb hit me over the head with it, I also know what the Snarks are picking up from Rock Coast and that snake Rydak. We're keeping an eye on them, though, and it's not as if the entire army's really out of the kingdom. We've got the training cadre here in Chiraeth, and the new recruits are shaping up nicely. There's not much question about their loyalty, and I think the Zebedians coming in from Howell may be even more rabidly loyal than my Chisomians. There was some truth to that, Merlin reflected. In fact, there was quite a lot of truth to it. Although the Imperial Carisian army had now deployed virtually all of its combat formations to Sidermark, its training battalions remained behind. That represented a good 20,000 men, many combat veterans, two-thirds of them stationed in or just outside Chiraeth or in Michaelburg, the Royal Chisomian Army's traditional headquarters, less than 300 miles to the north. And she was right about the recruits those training battalions were taking on. It might be too much to say Chisomians were flocking to the colors at this late date, but the influx of new volunteers was enough to make any thought of conscription unnecessary. Still more were coming in from Emerald, Taro, and Zebediah, and the Zebedians' enthusiasm burned bright. I guess it shouldn't be that surprising, he thought. Howell Cherman's the first honest Grand Duke Zebediah's had, and he's sudden death on abuses of power. Doesn't have much patience with corrupt judges either. And didn't that come as an unhappy surprise to the previous Grand Duke's cronies? Zebediah had been no paradise even before Coruscant conquered it. Now, after decades of Hector Dakin and Thomas Simmons, Hector's choice as Grand Duke, the people of Zebediah had been given a taste of honest, efficient governance, and it had come as a profound shock to the Grand Duchy system. Not all Zebedians, especially among the nobly born, were pleased with the new arrangements, but Chairman's reputation as a highly competent general and the 30,000 well-officered and equipped men at his command were more than enough to convince anyone who might contemplate rebellion to rethink his position. The Baron of Green Valley had systematically dismantled the Zebedian army, which had been the last Grand Duke's creature, and Chairman had built well upon Green Valley's foundation. In addition, the last of the aristocracy's armies of personal retainers had been disbanded by imperial edict. Grand Duke Howell had embraced that edict enthusiastically, and his troops had seen to its enforcement with speed and efficiency. For the first time in Zebedian memory, the army was actually seen as protector, not predator.